listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. Today we take a walk through the stories on the front page of Consortium News with Editor-in-Chief Joe Loria. Joe, I'd like to start with the new writers that you've welcomed to Consortium News. Coincidentally, the banner headline at consortiumnews.com, new writers welcomed to Consortium News. Let's talk about some of those.
That's where you got that from.
Yeah. I'm an investigative journalist.
You did. You unearthed that, Don. Great work.
Thank you so much.
Yes, the headline is new writers welcome to Consortium News. I wanted to give a wrap up to our readers about what's been going on at the website in the last few months. I've made an effort to recruit some pretty big names in alternative journalism. And I've reduced the number of writers we have, and I'm trying to concentrate on accomplished writers, which makes a hell of a lot easier to edit this stuff. That's really one of the, I admit, one of the motivating factors. No, but the real purpose, of course, is to get really high quality stuff online on our site. Writing original articles for us now is Pepe Escobar, who might be should be very familiar to your listeners. Pepe is just a terrific and kind of unique writer, Brazilian journalist who's, you don't know whether he's in Hong Kong or Paris or Italy. I can never nail the guy down. A couple times I was abroad. I went to Hong Kong once. I went to Paris once, thought I would meet with him, but of course he wasn't in either Hong Kong or Paris those days that I was there. So I've never met Pepe, but I've interacted with him in email, whatnot, and I'm really happy he decided to write for us. He's done a couple of pieces already. I think he's particularly good on the East-West geopolitical battle that's going on now. The really big picture stuff.
He's been writing for Asia Times for a very long time. So, you know,
he wrote for Asia Times a long time. Then I think Asia Times closed or for a while. Now it's back up and he's writing for them again.
Yeah.
So, yes, that's where he does most of his work. But he does publish elsewhere, and I'm really happy Consortium News is one of them. He's, again, really good on China and Russia versus the West and the machinations going on there. That was one piece he wrote for us recently about that, how the U.S. is painting itself into a corner, really, by trying to isolate Russia and China. The U.S. is actually isolating itself. And he's also very good on really the – these are all big picture things, but he's filled with details. This is why I really love Pepe's work, because he is like a massive painting that's of a big theme of a battle, let's say, but then there's so much detail in there. So he's good on big picture and enormously good on filling it out with details. And he's good on the other big issue of the what's going on in terms of politics in the West. And that is what a failure of the ruling circles here, of our neoliberal leaders for the last 30 years, they've ignored the destruction of the middle class, basically. And that economic crisis that they've willfully created in order to enrich themselves even more than they already were has left an angry electorate in many countries in Europe, United States, and in Brazil. And by not attending to the needs of those people, I include the Democratic and Republican parties in the U.S., they have opened up the way for right-wing populists to exploit that anger. And that's what Donald Trump did. And now we've got this guy, Jair Bolsonaro, who just won the first round of the Brazilian election on Sunday. He only got 48%, and that means that he is...
Right, second round.
Yeah, he's got to go to the second round. But let's hold off on that because we're talking about the new writers. So Pepe's one of them. Right. And I think after we're going to discuss in detail that piece on Brazil. Max Blumenthal, who's also probably very well known to your readers. Max is one of the best journalists in alternative media that there is. He does actual reporting. He's brilliant. And he did a piece, a brilliant obituary of Senator John McCain that, as I write, gave you everything that was missing from the New York Times.
Right.
In other words, the other side of John McCain that was left out, that was the headline I gave it. And that was a terrific piece that actually got, and I didn't check recently, but it got over 60,000 page views. And there's no story in Consortium News' history that we are in our memory that ever got that many views. So it was an enormously popular piece. It was timely because McCain had just died. And it gave us the facts about his awful work in Ukraine, in many places, Syria, of course, and his warmongering, which he was really good at, unfortunately. Yeah. So we're really happy to have Max on board. And Patrick Lawrence, who has been a longtime contributor to The Nation and Salon and other alternative media, has joined us. He writes a two times a month column. He also was the Asia editor of the International Herald Tribune. So Patrick, like myself, has worked in mainstream media before, and as Bob Perry did. And so we're really happy to have his columns. Now we have Assad Abdul Khalil, who is known as the Angry Arab. He runs a really terrific blog called the Angry Arab News Service. I recommend it to everyone out there if you are interested in a really incisive view of what's going on in the Middle East. Now, Assad is a Lebanese. He teaches out in California, in Modesto, California, at a university. So sometimes he is even too deep for somebody like myself or others in the West who are pretty clued into the Middle East. I've spent almost 3 years living in the Middle East. I've written quite a lot about it over the years. I consider myself informed as an American anyway about the major issues in the Middle East. But when you read Assad's blog, I learned so much from him. Yeah. It goes very, very deep in the way he's giving a real perspective from an Arab, not American or Europeans orientalist view. You know, what we think the Arabs think, we're getting from Assad at exactly what an Arab thinks, and an extremely well-informed Arab. And he's had a background as a Marxist. He's a leftist. He's a secularist. And that's a dying breed in the Middle East. Mm. There used to be a lot more of those back going to the 50s with NASA and all the way through the 70s. And
well, when you say dying breed, the dying was helped along an awful lot by the United States.
I was about to say that.
Yes.
That the Ameri- U.S. and Britain in particular, but other Western countries have worked very, very, and the Gulf Arab states, of course, the monarchies, the religious monarchies, have worked assiduously in the last 30 years to destroy that and build up religious extremism as their cudgel to try to get rid of the secular regimes that the Saudis have hated, going back to the Nasser and Saudi war, really, over in Yemen. And this has been the battle for the heart of the Middle East. And unfortunately, another bad bit of news is that the secularists have been losing. Why? They're trying to overthrow Bashar al-Assad, and they overthrew Gaddafi. These are two of the old secularist leaders, Saddam Hussein, and I am not supporting any of those guys, Saddam being the absolute worst. I don't think you could even, in terms of his brutality. But just in terms of religious extremism being used to destroy secularist governments that could be independent of the West. That's the main issue. The Americans and the Brits particularly want to get rid of these guys. The Brits tried to assassinate Nasser, as we know, but failed. And they helped establish in 1925 the Muslim Brotherhood, the British government, as a way, again, to fight against secularist and socialist tendencies in the Middle East. And again, unfortunately, that's why they wanted to get rid of Assad and Saddam, because these governments are sometimes standing up to the U.S. and to Europe, to the West. And that cannot be tolerated, obviously. And the Gulf Arabs don't want these guys because they are republics and they could have a bad influence in their own monarchies, which are very shaky, of course, all the time. They have to rule with an iron fist. And so the secularism is a threat to, and any kind of democracy at all is a threat to the Saudi regimes and the other regimes in the region.
Hey, even Trump admitted that, right? Trump said to
2 weeks.
He said you guys wouldn't last 2 weeks without our military.
You got to love him sometimes.
He tells the truth, that's for sure.
Yeah, well, sometimes, yes.
Yep.
Yeah. He can. I mean, he's not a politician, obviously. And so that's valuable when he says things like that.
Yeah,
that
for sure.
Piss them off. They had to piss the Saudis off.
Oh, man, I was just imagining.
They are dependent on him and would fall in 2 weeks. So they can't really say anything.
That's right. Yeah, right. Because otherwise, then they'll fall in 2 weeks.
And they love him anyway because of his first trip abroad was to Saudi Arabia. He did the sword dance, the whole BS, which I think Trump loved all that pomp and circumstance. I mean, if you look at the throne room where he was seated with King Salman, it looked a little bit like his apartment in Trump Tower, Trump's apartment.
It did.
Same
Gaudy.
Kind of over-the-top, Gaudi, awful taste, right?
Yeah, right.
So they got things in common there. Yep.
Nouveau. Nouveau riche.
Nouveau riche,
classless
exactly.
Nouveau riche. Yeah, I know. It's like, but you know, the thing that's... driving that, of course, when Trump went over there, he came back with a $65 billion check or whatever for, to sell whatever weapon systems the Saudis wanted to continue their mass murdering.
That's what it's all about, that relationship. Is that an oil going the other way?
That's right.
Weapons one way, oil the other.
That's right. So that's the angry Arab. Who else we got?
We have Alexander Mikouris, who is has a legal background and has turned to journalism recently. Particularly like Alexander and his analysis. I think it's dispassionate and wise. And you may not agree with everything he writes, but I do most of the time. He's a big, sharp. I asked him to write for us only about British politics. I didn't want him writing about Russia, which he does, of course, at the Duran, which he's the editor-in-chief of. I wanted somebody, my original idea, and I still might be able to pull this off, is to have a correspondent in major countries around the world to write at least once or twice a month about the internal politics. I think
where they are. Yeah, good idea.
Yeah, living in the country and writing from the perspective. I want a Brit writing about British politics, an Indian writing about India, Arabs writing about Arab countries. At least we have Assadis in California, but he is certainly an Arab and an angry one at that. and so I got Alexander to agree to write this, and I modeled it after Alistair Cook's Letter from America. Remember that on the BBC for years and years and years. They used to listen on the BBC World Service on shortwave years ago. Alistair Cook used to give great insights into American politics, much better than any American journalist was giving. Yeah. He was based here in Washington, where I am, and it was really a treat to listen to Alistair Cook's Letter from America. So I asked Alexander to write a letter from Britain, and which he's doing, and I think it gives great insight into British politics. I'm really happy he's doing that.
Great.
The next one I mentioned is John Kiriakou, of course, who you may have had on your show. He's a former CIA agent who blew the whistle on torture. And, of course, he and Chelsea Manning did the most to expose torture and war crimes by the U.S., and nobody from the U.S. has gone to U.S. government who've perpetrated these crimes has gone to prison, but Chelsea Manning and John Kiriakou
did. That's right. John
has.
Those
are the ones who were in prison.
John's been too busy. He does a daily radio show with Brian Becker down in D.C., down by you guys, for Sputnik. So,
that's right. I've been on the show numerous times in the studio or from here in Alexandria. I'm a regular, and I really enjoy it. That's an excellent show.
Yeah, I was on once, too.
Nobody has me on. Now? You must have said something.
I don't know what it is. So John co-hosts with Brian. It's on every day.
Brian Becker and John Kiriakou. It's called... you mind if I plug their show?
Go for it.
Loud and Clear. Yeah. I really recommend it. I don't get to listen to it every day, but every time I do, they've got excellent guests. Yep. Brian Beck is brilliant.
It's 2 hours, too.
It's a great show.
There's a lot of meat to it. Yeah.
And they cover a lot of stuff in great detail. It's on FM radio here and AM, actually, in the Washington area.
We air it also on Community Public Radio at communitypublicradio.org. Yep. Yeah, it's part of We do a 3-hour daily news magazine, and 2 hours of it is usually Loud and Clear with Brian and
John. You listen to it mostly every day, then, so you know
pretty much, yep.
How good it is. Yep. So John is writing also a column for us once or twice a month. I'm really happy about that. And then I mentioned the ones who've been writing for some time for us. Ray McGovern, of course, Gareth Porter, Daniel Lazar, Jonathan Marshall, Marjorie Cohn, sort of our legal correspondent, and Diana Johnstone, long writer from France.
Yeah.
First within these times, I think it was, years and years ago.
She's fantastic.
And Annie. Yeah, I'm really happy she's writing for us. And Annie. Machon, who is former MI5.
Right.
British agent who was a whistleblower herself and is writing interesting stuff for us. And then we've got other writers too that I didn't mention, but those are the regulars.
The stable, as you've
the stable. The stable. So now I wrote this column for a reason, but I can't mention it, but you can.
Yeah, and there is. I know that you guys do fundraising like everybody else. Details about how you do it and all of that are at the website, consortiumnews.com, with the rest of the news. Suffice to say that there's no, like this program, like this radio station that you're listening on, or this particular platform you're listening on, nobody's making any money here. We're doing this because we're trying to share information around, around the world. That's what we're doing. And, help everybody do that. Spread this stuff around yourselves.
We're doing this because there needs to be an alternative to the mainstream press. The stories that they suppress or that they omit facts from, it's legion. So there's got to be websites like ours that try to fill in those cracks, and anybody who's interested in from a different perspective could have it. That's why we're trying to keep going.
So let's jump into this first piece. This is Pepe Escobar from the new section of the stable, and he's in Paris for this particular piece, talking about what's happening in Brazil. And for some context, people, we have commonly speak with Tony Solo and cover Latin America once a week, in some detail. And people that have been listening for years, even if you didn't know before, understand that part of the sort of the decay of the Western Empire includes a loosening of the grip of the Monroe Doctrine. The U.S. Really began in earnest this time around with the election of Hugo Chavez in 1998 and the development of the whole process, first in and then around Venezuela, where you ended up 4 or 5 years ago. Venezuela, Argentina, Brazil, Nicaragua, Ecuador, Bolivia, and Uruguay, all having leftist governments, Honduras also, and then a pushback, rollback, coupback, all kinds of different games, actual warfare against Venezuela, for example, one of the casualties was President Dilma Rousseff, who was the socialist president that was removed from office by the right wing for nothing, when that happened, a right-winger took office who immediately was exposed as a thief, an outright thief. His numbers for the last year and a half have been hovering around 2% favorable, and he managed to sit out the term of Dilma Rousseff until the election. The first phase was this past Sunday, and the most popular politician in Brazil, Lula da Silva, who was the previous socialist president, the socialist president for two terms before Dilma Rousseff, who would win hands down, was also imprisoned by the right wing and forbidden to run for office because he would win. Even the UN, the Human Rights Agency and one of the UN courts said he should be allowed to, and directed the Brazilian government to let him run. Nevertheless, he's out. So this right-wing, essentially fascist, won the first round, shy of what he needed to win the office. And this is what Pepe is talking about, just the context.
Yeah, all that what you just described was totally engineered. We knew that guy was a thief before he became president.
Right.
And they got her out, and they imprisoned Lula. This is all engineered from powerful interests in Brazil, probably with American backing. I don't think there's any doubt about that.
No doubt.
And what it's all led to is this guy, Bolsonaro, who I feel the F word is overused these days. Mm-hmm. Everybody you disagree with is automatically a fascist. I mean, on social media. It's ridiculous. So I am very careful not to use that word because I think it's weakening the meaning of the word.
But,
you know, this case, I mean, I had to read this story and I took a few of them out. Pepe, you know, my editing, he went overboard.
Yeah.
But I had to admit, the reason why I think that is because of his links or his support for the military dictatorships of Brazil of the last century,
which he criticizes as being weak. Okay, and as he surveyed the landscape of the various right-wing governments that have, you know, been installed by the U.S. and by the various militaries in the region, he criticizes them for being weak, including Pinochet.
Yeah, well, that tells you something. That tells you a lot right there.
Whew.
But in my view, those dictatorships were fascist. It was really classic European-style fascistic regimes in Pinochet, in Chile, and various dictators in Argentina and in Brazil and other places, Paraguay. So this was no accident that they absorbed European-type fascists, where a lot of Nazis had escaped to, of course, in South America. So the idea that this guy would support Brazilian military dictatorship, said it was the best time in Brazil's recent history, and he's also picked a running mate who was a general, and he was himself an army officer, Bolsonaro, that this general was talking about the possibility of a military coup in Brazil. So short of that, we're going to maybe get this guy, which might be very similar to the military running the country. They will certainly have a lot more to say, I would think, if Bolsonaro wins the second round. And this is a cry here from Pepe in Paris, who happens to be, of course, a Brazilian journalist. So he knows Brazil inside and out, even though he's in Paris right now. But it's a cry from him to say, we've got 3 weeks to do something about this guy, because the runoff is on October 28th. So that's like 18 days from now. The left wing, the party of Lula, because Lula couldn't run, is being headed by Haddad. Trying to remember his first name here, Fernando Haddad of the Workers' Party.
Right.
He only got 29% compared to the 46% that Bolsonaro got. Now, Pepe points out, if Haddad were to win, or even just become even with Bolsonaro, he needs every vote from those who supported the other candidates. In other words, not Bolsonaro or Haddad, but all the third and fourth place candidates.
Right.
They got their was like 20% of the vote, the others.
Right.
I'm wrong about that. But he's saying it's 20% of the votes were considered null and void.
Right.
So Haddad needs those 20% of null and void, and he needs the votes, everyone, from the third, in order to even to draw even Bolsonaro. So it looks very dire right now.
Yeah.
And
it's not only that. If Haddad were to win, they would probably remove him from office within the first couple of months, because the legislatures and Brazil has an interesting confederation of governments. The governors there have a lot of power, and the state governments there have a lot of power. But the federal government, the federal legislature there, the right wing captured that pretty handily in the election last Sunday, and so Haddad would be, you know, facing an enemy Congress, basically, if he wins.
That's a very good point. They the way they removed Dilma and threw Lula in jail, they could make something up to get Haddad out if he wins, but it doesn't look like he will, and that's bad news.
Yep.
Pepe, in his inimitable way, talks about the goddess of the market embraces him. The investors, semi-divine entities, they love him because he's good for the market. The real, the Brazilian currency, soared, and the Sao Paulo Stock Exchange soared after his great showing in the first round.
The trains ran out of time.
And Wall Street loves him. And the thing is, these are people who are amoral and sociopathic because all they care about is capital accumulation, their own capital accumulation, and they don't give a damn about the effects that this will have on a society that a few years ago, as Pepe points out, was doing extremely well under Lula in terms of its economy and social progress.
That's right.
And now it's being totally destroyed. These are human lives, millions of lives.
That's right.
Being absolutely ruined for the sake of a few very greedy sons of SOBs.
Right.
And this guy is a big-time SOB, this Bolsonaro, I have to say, according to Pepe's piece here. And Pepe then links what's going on in Brazil to what's happening in Europe, and to some extent to the U.S. He doesn't think – he's been called, Bolsonaro, the tropical Trump, okay?
Right.
Pepe thinks that it's more complicated than that, that this guy is not a sovereigntist the way Trump is and the alt-right, so-called alt-right, whatever, in Europe are, that he would be a complete puppet of Washington. So he's not about Brazil and Brazilian rights and Brazilian jobs and Brazil's identity and against globalization. He would be a total puppet of the United States, and he would just bow down like the military dictatorships were, who were dependent on Washington. He'd have his own power locally, as they did, but his policies would be dictated from Washington on for the most part. And that's why he thinks, Pepe does, that he's not like Trump, and he's not like the sovereigntists, the populist right wing that's gaining in Europe. But he does think that if Bolsonaro wins, that will give impetus to that right wing in Europe, and which is being stoked by Mr. Steve Bannon. And Pepe has it's a long piece. It's very worth reading because he links, he tells us a lot about Bannon, what he's doing in Europe right now. And you don't read this too much anywhere else. And Bannon is going around starting a movement, a think tank in Brussels called The Movement. And he's in a lot of times he's in Italy and he's going around the continent stirring up this right-wing anti-EU populist coalition. And while I have a lot of criticism of the EU, and I think it's been in many ways a disaster for democracy and also for the economy in terms of the average people of Europe who've been subjected to this austerity, particularly Greece being the most notable case, the right-wing populist coalition, the right wing is scary. It's anti-immigrant. And that's really one of their most important calling cards. And it's right wing. And there's a failure of the left. And this is what Pepe writes about in this piece as well. The failure of the left in Europe, in the United States, and in Brazil, although that was engineered, as you discussed and you mentioned earlier, is leading to this very, very dangerous situation. And if Bolsonaro wins, which looks like he will, it will just give a jolt to this right-wing populist movements around the world that are not good for them, are not the way to fight the EU and austerity, and that, in my opinion, and Pepe's. But there's no left-wing popularism, and there are efforts to try to define it. There are some thinkers and writers in Europe that Pepe then goes through at the end of the piece to explain how they're trying to map out or explain how there could be a left populist movement. But as Pepe says, right now that rests in the realm of utopia, and that the only way to block this coming dystopia in Brazil is to try to get a democratic front, a progressive democratic front, to stop Bolsonaro winning. But again, it's a very pessimistic piece, I have to say.
You know, you have to look at the larger condition in Brazil, of course. You have, if he were to win, again, you have essentially the right wing is an entrenched power. They have control of the judiciary. They never lost control of the judiciary. even through Lula's terms in office, even through Dilma Rousseff, which is how they were able to remove both of them from the political playing field.
Right.
And began that effort in earnest with the removal of Dilma from the presidency. So you have that condition. What they seem to be doing, though, I mean, this is the same situation that exists in Argentina. The West has been marketing the idea that there is a resurgence, what they call it, something revival, like it's against the pink tide that rose before there's some sort of a revival of the right wing that's supposed to be coming into power. And so you had first the removal of Zelaya by a coup, and then sort of a soft coup around that time in Paraguay. In Uruguay, you had a change of government. You had the election in 2015 in Argentina, where Macri edged out Da Silva. And the situation in Venezuela has, been a crisis, but there's almost a direct war, warfare going on from the U.S., but, that crisis also. And then, so the governments in Argentina and Brazil in particular, the two largest economies in South America, got turned around pretty much simultaneously by similar but not identical methods. And the problem with Brazil is that Brazil is the B in BRICS, the transnational multilateral alternative to Western global capitalism.
Yeah.
That's the B in BRICS. And, you've had a change of government also in South Africa, which is the S in BRICS, and India keeps flip-flopping from one way or another. So,
this is right winger.
It's an offensive from New York and wherever else, London, Berlin, and that is that's the context for the whole thing. So, we're just about out of time. I got about 30 seconds. If you want to tell us about one more piece here, there was something that Ray McGovern was talking about with.
Yes, I just wanted to say that they are trying to remove brick by brick, the BRICS around the periphery of Russia and China. The last piece to talk about quickly is one by Ray McGovern. He just talked about how he was meeting Daniel Ellsberg a couple of years ago when the film came out about Daniel Ellsberg, and he Stan dropped a folder. And he picked it up, and inside were all these printed out articles from Consortium News. Ah. So Dan is a big supporter of Consortium News.
Excellent.
And that's why Ray wrote that piece.
And next time I talk to him, I'm going to see if I can't get him to do a promo for you. Joe, thank you very much. We'll catch you next week.
All the best, Don. Bye-bye.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
And welcome to Worlds Apart. The Americans in general and the Trump administration in particular are never shy of extolling their economic achievements, and not without merit. The American economy of late has indeed been looking great. But there is an increasing number of economists who claim that this boom may be short-lived and is setting the stage for yet another global crisis. If the fall indeed comes, how hard is it likely to be? Well, to discuss it, I'm now joined by Brunello Rosa, founder and CEO at Rosa & Rubini Associates. Mr. Rosa, it's good to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, over the last couple of weeks, we've heard a number of prominent economists warn that the global economic growth may be slowing down, but I think you've been the most pessimistic of all, predicting a new global crisis around 2020 that may be similar in scale or perhaps even worse than the one we saw in 2008. Is that still a possibility or already a certainty?
No, of course, it's a probabilistic assertion in the sense that we look at various scenarios for the world economy and we attach probabilities to them. What we do compared to other economists out there and research houses is we attach a higher probability to such an event to occur, around 45%. And this is based on a number of forces that we see already at play. And we can think, and we think that over the next couple of years would have gathered strength and might actually coalesce to cause a downturn that is more severe than what we have seen potentially in 2008 and more severe than most economists are currently expecting.
And I think people around the world do take your prediction seriously, especially after your partner and co-author, Nouriel Roubini, accurately predicted the 2008 downturn. I gather it from your writing, though, that if this next crisis comes, its origins are likely to be more multifactorial than the origins of the crisis that we saw previously.
Definitely. The 2008 crisis somehow originated in the US in the subprime mortgage sector and then spread to the rest of the world. Although, of course, the intimate and ultimate causes of the crisis were already present and they were already global at that time. The fragilities in the banking system were already very present. The failures of some regulation, including Basel II and the tendency of banks of bringing a lot of their assets off balance sheets were global phenomena. But of course, you know, the ultimate trigger of the crisis was the explosion, so to speak, of the subprime mortgage market in the US. This time around is more a question of having a number, as you suggested, of factors at play, and they originate in different parts of the world.
Absolutely. And in your recent article with Nouriel Roubini, you give 10 reasons for why the next crisis is on the cards. But you start with the United States and what you call poorly timed fiscal stimulus policies. And by that, I assume you mean Trump's 2017 concession of some $130 billion in additional spending that went into infrastructure, childcare, treating the opioid epidemics. Is there ever a bad time to invest in those areas?
No, I mean, the problem of the tax reform and to some extent of the tax cuts of the U.S. administration, and they come quite late in the cycle when the recovery was already very well established, perhaps on the verge of slowing down, but at the time in which the Federal Reserve was already increasing rates and therefore the economy was already somehow prone to inflationary pressures and therefore giving an extra kick, while justifiable if you wish for political reasons, from a pure economic standpoint was a bit ill-timed. Plus, the point is that these tax reform and tax cuts are timed just to make sure that the federal budget doesn't completely explode and therefore they tend to expire towards the end of next year. And that is when we fear some negative impact may occur on the U.S. economy because the effects of these tax cuts taper off and you might face a fiscal cliff.
But it's not just about the tax cuts. There was also additional spending, as I said. And I think this claim that the stimulus program was ill-timed may upset not only Trump supporters, but also some people on the Democratic side who claim that if there's anything good to come out of the Trump administration on the economic front, it was proving that fiscal stimulus actually works when the labor market is short of its full potential, as was the case in 2017. Don't you think that the growth in the job numbers counterbalance or justify the negatives that you mentioned, like, for example, the inflationary pressures?
It's always good to have more jobs than less jobs. But the unemployment rate is now below 4%. Well, nobody really knows where the Nairo is. Might be 4.5 or around there. So we are already below the natural rate of unemployment. Therefore, of course, every additional job is a good one. But then you have to counterbalance what instruments you're using against the result that you actually achieve in terms of growth. You might gain a few more quarters of positive growth, a few more hundred thousands of jobs. But then what happens to inflation and what happens to the reaction of the central bank to this inflation? Because the central bank needs to make sure that inflation remains on target. And we already see that it's above target. And then when they react, then you start having impact on everything else we discussed, on investment potential, because interest rates are higher, on consumption growth, and eventually on employment. So that's why you tend to use fiscal policy in a counter-cyclical manner rather than in a pro-cyclical manner.
Now, I know that you are partial to the financial instability hypothesis, which essentially posits that the fragility of the system increases in good times, partly because economic actors don't want to upset that growth, even when they realize that it may not be organic or sustainable. How much does it apply to what you now see in the American economy? And would you go as far as to say that the higher it flies right now, the harder the fall is going to be in 2020?
Yes, that tends to be the case. And you mentioned correctly Hyman Minsky financial instability hypothesis, which is somehow still heterodox, although has been increasingly accepted among mainstream economists after the 2008 crisis. Effectively, things get incrementally worse in good times, and people tend not to realize that the number of positions becomes exposed, speculative or ultra-speculative, the way Minsky put it. And then eventually, when something happens, and this something tends to be an increase in interest rate that goes beyond a certain point, then you tend to have a reversal. And the higher you've been, the more severe the downturn tends to be. Now, historically, when the Fed has increased rates, after a short period of time from the peak, a recession, a contraction, or a marked slowdown has always occurred. And it would be quite unusual if this were not to be the case, especially because nobody really knows where's the level at which interest rate becomes really restrictive.
Now, Trump has spent the last couple of months and, well, almost a year already, extolling his administration economic genius, the job growth, the economic expansion, and he's certainly unwilling to share any of the credit with the previous administration. But I wonder if this next crisis, as you predict, come, would it be fair to blame it exclusively on him?
No, look, it's not a question of blaming people or administrations, not even perhaps policies. We live history, and in fact, tends to accumulate over time. After the 2008-2009 crisis, the Fed and the government that became a Democratic administration at that point had to impart quite a substantial stimulus, both in terms of monetary easing and in terms of fiscal easing. And the combination of the two, in fact, worked, plus the stabilization of the banking system via some regulation such as the Dodd-Frank and so on. So these policies have worked because the economy has recovered and the recipe somehow has worked. That has worked a little bit less so in other countries where part of this recipe was not applied, in particular the fiscal stimulus. So it's very hard for any politician of any color, of any administration, to stop the party when it's going. In fact, they would like the party to continue as long as possible. What we claim is that the market forces are such that eventually a downturn becomes inevitable, whatever the administration and whatever the color of that administration might be.
Now, Mr. Rosa, I know that you also contend that if this perfect storm hits, the policy tools available to the current administration for addressing it will sorely be lacking. Why is that?
More than lacking, I would say, that might be constrained. Well, around the globe, because some of what is called policy space might be reduced, and it can be reduced because just think about just to make a very simple example, the U.S. Federal Reserve interest rates, they started at 5.25 before the previous crisis. They reached virtually zero, and maybe they are going to go up to, say, 3.5%. You can see already that the Fed has less room to cut interest rate. That's already a reduction in policy space. The balance sheet that could be bloated massively via QE and other programs from the Fed and has reached the $4-5 trillion US dollar remains bloated in spite of the quantitative tightening. Fiscal space, most countries started the fight to the last crisis with a debt to GDP ratio of around 30, 40, 50%. Only some very indebted countries started from a higher level. But most countries now have their debt to GDP ratio in the 100% space, the US being one, but that could be France, it could be the UK, could be other countries that have been virtually, have been fiscally virtuous in the past. So once they have to apply those instruments, fiscal and monetary policy, they might find less policy space. In other jurisdictions, and in particular in Europe, there has been some form of revolt against the policies that were adopted to fight the crisis, in particular the austerity measures that were adopted, which means that if more of those policies were to be adopted in the future, populations might not be as recipient as they were in the past.
Mr. Rosa, let me stop you for a second here because we need to take a very short break, but I hope we will come back to this discussion and look into the implications of that potential economic crisis a bit more. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Brunella Rosa, founder and CEO at Rosa & Rubini Associates. Mr. Rosa, just before the break, we were discussing this very gloomy scenario that you painted out. And I heard you say that if that indeed happens, the political implications in the 2020 electoral year could be massive, especially taking into account the character of the current American president. What is your worst fear?
It's not just is not just in the US. In a number of countries, political developments have shown a very different direction from the past. Now, regarding the US, we have one of the factors that might be contributing to a potential severe downturn is the possibility that presidents facing a potential, say, economic crisis tend to turn to other instruments to gather consensus around them. That has happened a number of times in the past.
And by other instruments, I think you mean some sort of a foreign policy crisis. And in your article specifically, you mentioned Iran as a potential target, right?
Exactly, because what I was about to say is that presidents can work effectively on trade, migration, foreign policy and defense almost without the necessarily consent of Congress, and Congress by that time might be divided and not necessarily of the same color of the president, in which case, having already worked a lot on trade and migration, is defense and foreign policy the instruments that remains in the hands of the president, and therefore he might be tempted to some form of military intervention in the Middle East, being Iran a potential target.
But with all due respect, for all his alleged recklessness and impulsivity, Trump is the first president that hasn't initiated a new conflict, the first president in, I think, 3 decades. And even when it comes to Syria, he certainly bombed Syria, but the Russians would tell you that it was done in a very careful, in a very limited manner. What makes you believe that Trump would indeed move from his bombastic threats to the actual bombing? Because so far he hasn't done it.
And in fact, in my note, we are still talking about a probabilistic scenario here. And in my weighting the assumptions here, everything we are saying is a number of assumptions that we are making on 10 different fronts, and is the cumulative impact of them that might be resulting in the severe downturn that we are discussing. Foreign policy from the U.S. is one of them, but not necessarily the only one. In fact, it might realize that again engaging American troops in the Middle East after having taken years to withdraw from them might not be as advantageous as initially appearing, and therefore it might not go for that. We are just saying that it's definitely an option on the table.
Historically, leaders do indeed look for distractions abroad because that's where it's easier to find enemies to blame. But Trump is unique in having no shortage of enemies at home. Wouldn't it be easier and perhaps more logical for him to blame all the potential failures on saboteurs at home, like, for example, the Fed?
Definitely, and that's not excluded at all. In fact, we were seeing that Trump already somehow broke some of the traditional rules of not commenting on what the Fed has done by making, in fact, some statements about what the Fed perhaps should do in order to allow the U.S. economy to grow even faster, potentially. If he did so when rates were barely at 2% and growth was around 3% with unemployment falling, you can imagine the kind of rhetoric that he can use when the economy might be slowing down. Interest rates will be between 3 and perhaps 3.5%, and unemployment perhaps on his way up. You can definitely see how he can increase the rhetoric against the Fed or potentially Congress again if he gets at least half of it in the hands of the Democrats after the midterm elections.
Now, as of the end of last year, about half of the U.S.'s public debt was owned by foreign investors, mainly China and Japan. Given Trump's posture on trade with China, do you think Beijing or even Tokyo may change their strategies with regards to the American holdings?
It's very hard for that to happen. You really need a catastrophe in order to do that, because there are many deep and liquid and safe enough spaces where to park the massive amount of reserves that both China and Japan have. And we know they are part of the geopolitical equilibrium that is currently in place. And therefore, as I was saying, for them to change this strategy, you really need a change in the geopolitical equilibrium. Now, in China, you need to consider that, yes, we are seeing trade skirmishes the way we might define them. Of course, some tariffs might be hurting and might be hurting China. We saw that already. But the reality there is that there's a underlying technological war, much more important than the trade skirmishes that we see on the surface. And this is around the Agenda 2025 that the Chinese government is pursuing in order to get the leadership in a number of high-tech and top industries of the future. It's really more about that the trade dynamics that is on the surface. So geopolitics at this stage is more run around this kind of conflicts rather than full confrontation. As long as it remains in this kind of space, we don't see China and Japan changing completely the allocation of reserves.
Now, speaking about responding to that potential crisis more broadly, the 2008 crisis left a very strong, unpleasant aftertaste because of the financial sector bailouts, you know, nationalizing losses while privatizing profits. Do you think this too big to fail mantra can and should be applied again?
A number of measures have been taken from a regulatory perspective by a number of countries around the globe in order to diminish the so-called too-big-to-fail policy, leaving wills, various forms of separation within banking groups and so on and so forth in order to make them
but you know, it's still
manageable.
Not fully implemented. And
no, and it's not gonna happen between now and then, also because memories are past and the influence of financial institution has been such that in fact some of the restrictive policies have already been somehow already relaxed. And so the question is, will banks be able to withstand another severe crisis? And if they're not, who's going to pay for them? Now, the answer to the first question is they should be more resilient than they were in the past because they are better capitalized and they have more liquid assets. That was the result of the regulation that was imposed. But they might not withstand a complete market crash, let alone a meltdown. And in this case, fiscal resources will always be eventually the result. That, of course, will bitter populations even more. And therefore, that's why there's the risk of a severe political crisis after the next financial and economic crisis.
Now, you've pointed out in your article that the idea of bailouts will be particularly intolerable in countries with resurgent populist movements. But this kind of populism is self-contradictory because people certainly don't want national money to go into saving big banks, but they also don't want to see their savings evaporate. Do you think governments, even the populist governments, can really afford not to be populist in the sense of providing some sort of a cushion for the population in dealing with the banking situation?
Yeah, that's you pointed out correctly a blunt contradiction in populist economic positions. It's easy to find an enemy, whether foreigners, whether banks, whether the political opponents and so on. That's easy. Much more difficult is to explain how things are. Once you start telling people, look, you might hate the banks, but where do you put your money? Ah, you put them in the bank. And what happens if the bank goes under? You don't see your money anymore. Now you want me to intervene. Okay, so these kind of reasonings would be much more helpful to make people understand the real dynamics there and why people act on consequences of crisis that, of course, nobody wants. A different story is whether previous to the crisis, there has been, say, conflict of interest between politicians, market participants, academics, and so on, that has made the situation worse, and therefore people might feel betrayed by the elites, so to speak, of the economy and society, and therefore they have this kind of resentment. But even if that were to occur, the first line of defense is making sure that the banking system is stabilized, people have access to their savings, and only after then you think about solving somehow the domestic issues arising from that.
Now, speaking about populism very quickly, one interesting point you make is about Europe and the concern that the new crisis may amplify the existential problems of incomplete monetary union with inadequate risk sharing. And you even suggest that it may prompt Italy and others to actually exit the Eurozone altogether. Would that be a rational economic decision as far as the Italians are concerned?
Okay, let's take a step back. Yes, the fact that the monetary union is incomplete, it makes it vulnerable to shocks. Now, if those shocks were to occur to the order of magnitude that we said in the report, then the political leadership of Eurozone countries will have to make a decision, either to make a step forward, as it happened in the past, and finish and complete in the monetary union, or instead allowing the shocks to be asymmetric and leaving some countries in great difficulty. Assuming that this political will of not making a further step happens, It might not be there. It might be, but it might also not be there if, for example, the results of the 2019 European elections is in favor of these more nationalist parties, less in favor of further European integration. Then it's a question of how individual countries will react to that. And even if it's not a rational decision, if it's not, even if it's an unwanted decision, Italy and other countries might be finding themselves at the fringes of the euro area in a very difficult spot. And at that point will be either market forces, political will, or people's will that determines whether the monetary union remains together or not. And the risk is that it might not.
Well, Mr. Broza, I wish I could ask you a few more questions on that, but unfortunately our time is up. Thank you very much for sharing your perspective with us today.
Thank you for inviting me.
I encourage our viewers to keep this conversation going on our social media pages and hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, CommunityPublicRadio.org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.